Welcome to the Industrial IoT Spotlight, your number one spot for insight from industrial IoT thought leaders who are transforming businesses today, with your host, Eric Walenza.
Welcome back to the Industrial IoT Spotlight. I'm joined today by Triyu Wadka. Triyu is a partner with Seed Plus and Jungle Ventures. Seed Plus invests in deep technology startups out of Asia. They're based in Singapore, and Triyu focuses on devices, IoT, network infrastructure, operating systems, Industry 4.0, basically everything that we like to dig into on the Industrial IoT Spotlight. But let's talk more about cybersecurity. So is this certainly in IoT, it's a very important topic. It's, in IT generally, but in IoT, maybe uniquely because of the physical element and the fact that decisions made on IoT devices can actually impact people in the physical world and assets. What are you looking at in terms of IoT? What do you think is interesting in terms of maybe companies that have crossed your path or more generally market domains?
So I think one of the areas that we've kind of looked at in the IoT security side has been around the domain of how do you sort of secure operational technology? Because one of the fundamental challenges, if you look at the security world, it has been dominated on the IT side of the house, where TCP/IP was sort of commonly the protocol used to exchange information, and therefore you used what was built on top of TCP/IP. I think, unfortunately, what's happened is a lot of what TCP/IP did does not necessarily scale to operational technology, specifically in light of lack of memory, lack of a processor. You might have a microcontroller instead of a microprocessor. And the frequencies that are used, radio frequencies, may not be sufficient enough to actually have, you know, a standard TCP/IP-based or certificate authority-based model. Therefore, we are looking at ideas that either involve securing the endpoints, in this case, sensors, which means you need to think of new models where some of the conventional security protocols are customized and reduced to work in the environments where there's not enough of a memory capacity footprint. So that means going back to the fundamentals around what the size of some of these packets should be for exchange of information and you know, how do we sort of authenticate some of these nodes? So some of that stuff to also hearing some interesting views where they said, you know what, it's impossible to sort of secure these sensors. So the best thing would be to secure the gateways and just live with the likelihood of the sensors actually being not secure. So for us, it's about talking about low power, low capacity operational technology that has lived outside sort of the perimeter of standard IT security modules. And it ranges from simple manufacturing machines to all the way to, I would say, if one were to think about oil and gas, you know, we've seen some very, very strange things happening where IP camera configuration led a backdoor that led to sort of, you know, a huge amount of, I would say, damage to some of the oil infrastructure, led to billions of dollars of damages. So, you know, our focus has been to figure out what could be the right model, business model-wise, as well as security technology-wise, that could enable security of these operational technologies out in the wild.
Interesting. Yeah, I hadn't heard about that that issue in the oil and gas sector. Was that in 2017 or?
No, I think it was sometime before that, probably in the early 2010s, sometime in 12.
Gotcha. Was that a hack or a malicious play, or was it more of an accidental?
There was a flaw in the way the IP cameras were configured, which was exploited by the hackers, and they got a backdoor into the infrastructure of the oil rig, and the machinery went down.
What about in the smart cities play? I would say Singapore is one of the most advanced cities in terms of having a really comprehensive smart city strategy. What are you seeing there in terms of interesting companies with really unique solutions?
My approach here has been, any sort of top-down strategy has to be complemented with bottoms-up strategy. And I think one of the struggles that we've had about in looking at companies was companies that are taking the approach of smart cities being, I need to sell infrastructure to government, right? And I think a lot of the companies that we've seen in the smart city domain have taken that approach where they've said, I'm going to put new infrastructure or sell new infrastructure, and government's going to sort of buy it because it's part of their IoT smart city mandate. And I've heard this across the board. It's not just Singapore. Went to Taipei, I think I heard a similar story. I've heard this from China. I've heard this from Australia. So across the board in this part of the world, a lot of the companies are pushing for a worldview of smart cities where they're selling infrastructure to government. Where I come from, I'm suggesting that there is no need to rip and replace some of this infrastructure. How about using existing infrastructure more efficiently to deliver better outcomes for consumers? And I've been looking at ideas in that space where you're not sort of going in and saying, I'm going to add new sensor or millions of new sensors. I'm trying to figure out, can we use existing infrastructure and slap the mobile layer on and see if you can use those assets, the combination of the mobile phone with existing infrastructure to better use. So that's been my worldview. And I've tried to find companies that might be doing that versus those who are selling stuff to government and trying to sell infrastructure solutions to the government for either security or networks or surveillance or whatever that may be. I think that works, but it's not really something that I've seen scale from a venture standpoint.
Yeah, that's right. That might be the kind of technology that is, let's say, primed for acquisition by a company that already understands how to sell to governments and has the channels and is maybe looking for a technology acquisition, but then your upside is kind of limited there, right? There's a company you might want to have a look at called Turbine. Have you heard of them?
I may have. No, I would love to hear more.
They just got accepted into Alchemist Accelerator, which is kind of an IoT-focused, enterprise-focused accelerator out of the Valley. But really interesting, they've been in product development for about 2.5 years now, so they have a good solution going to beta. But they basically build a data marketplace or a data exchange for IoT data, because you have this big open question of everybody's focused on how do we collect the data, how do we move the data, how do we analyze the data, but how do we actually transact? So when you're talking about creating value in the city environment, a lot of data is already being created in city environments, but it's kind of sitting in particular silos. It's not very accessible, and so it's not being turned into valuable solutions. And so what they're focused on is building this exchange where people can tap into data streams and monetize that by turning it into valuable solutions, whether it's for government, for a car driver, for a drone operator, anybody who can kind of build a business model around the data set.
Got it. Yeah, I've seen some of this stuff. We've seen a couple of companies that have been trying to build data marketplaces in Singapore. And I think it's an interesting model. It's a useful model because the future of any artificial intelligence-based business is predicated on the quality and the kind of data that they act upon to train their models. And therefore, it makes sense to think of IoT sort of as not just the sensors collecting the data, but also the way data is analyzed or stored and exchanged. Place where we kind of have found a little bit of a challenge on that side of the house is how, and you know, something that needs to be solved perhaps is how do you kind of motivate enterprises to actually contribute to this data bank that they're building? And what is in it for the enterprise to share some of its confidential data that exists and resides inside its own four walls, which it believes it to be sort of its proprietary asset, perhaps in the new world, the most important asset that they would ever have. So I wonder with sort of very fundamentally the motivations of some of these organizations in terms of value exchange, are they really sharing all the data that they should to be useful? And if not, you know, what is the quality of the data that the data exchange can have? We've given this a fair amount of thought. I think as part of Seed Plus overall, marketplaces, or I would say unique sort of marketplaces are something that we think about. And in that sense, we see data marketplaces as very unique in that sense.
Have you considered investing in any? You mentioned that there's a couple companies working on the similar problems in Singapore.
We've considered, I would say we have looked at them, but the volume of the data and the quality of the data are questions that haven't been answered in our mind. I think at some point, these questions will get answered. I think the conviction around, it's a sort of a paradoxical problem, because the more valuable data becomes to enterprises, the less they are likely to share it with a common data pool. So how do you get make them incentivized enough to share data that's important enough to the ecosystem and get something back, right? So it's fascinating. I don't have a good answer, but that's what we found to be the most challenging piece, which is when we ask customers or potential customers who wanted to use some of these data exchanges, we landed up with answers which said, look, it's interesting, but the data, we don't know the veracity of the data. We don't know if it's going to be useful enough. I think startups are more likely to use it because they need training data sets. And for them, something like this boost sort of accelerates their growth. Because let's face it, right? A lot of the startups, even on the IoT side of the house, eventually you want to have a data play. You want to have a data and a play that's related to working on data sets that are massive on the back of a massive network of sensors that are collecting this data. But if you had a way to short circuit that and be able to train your machine learning without actually putting those sensors out, I think that should be of interest to a lot of early stage companies. But really, I mean, I haven't found application beyond that, where we have found big companies, you know, just standing up and saying, yeah, this makes sense. We can share our most secure and confidential data out in the market and for exchange because we believe other companies are doing the same. Not seen that yet.
Agreed. It's a very interesting area, but a lot of technical and business challenges. What about on the manufacturing space? So what we see in terms of manufacturing use cases are kind of bifurcated, right? On the one hand, you have very sophisticated use cases that might be used in oil and gas, for example, for maintaining equipment uptime. On the other hand, IoT provides, in some cases, really interesting, low-scale, simple spot solutions for small discrete manufacturing outfits that haven't invested significantly before because they don't want it, you know, they don't have an IT team, you know, et cetera. They're not going to put a big IT investment in place. But with an IoT solution, you can kind of do a simple deployment directly on legacy infrastructure. And so you kind of have these two different tracks. What's interesting to you in the manufacturing space? And I guess in Southeast Asia or in Asia, you have both, right? You have Korea, Singapore, Japan, very high-end manufacturing. And then you've got, you know, Vietnam and a lot of really manual manufacturing that also has room for improvement, but, you know, very, very thin profit margins.
Yeah, you know, I disagree with some of that because this was sample size equal to one. I looked at some of the manufacturing stuff happening up in Japan. I got some views about it and I was surprised. I think the need to maintain quality leads to human intervention beyond what is obvious. And this is specifically for more complex, products. And one would be surprised that even Japan, with all its sort of advancements, has a lot of manual component to this whole game. So I would sort of say why I would love to sort of differentiate between low-end manufacturing and high-end manufacturing. I would say that even at the highest end, it is surprising as to the extent in which humans are involved in the final product. And therefore, you know, some of the learnings on the lower end of the manufacturing complexity scale apply even to the higher end. Having said that, the stuff that we have seen is a lot of the IoT startups that we've seen, and, you know, think of manufacturing as sort of one big cloud of space. They think of manufacturing as a vertical. And I feel that's sort of a fundamental flaw in the way they think about it, because there are various ways to actually slice and dice manufacturing. And I've learned this the hard way after looking at companies in the space. So it could be that you're a high volume, low mix, so you could be a low mix or high mix, low volume. You could be a combination. There could be, you know, sort of more discrete processing versus more continuous processing. It could be a large setup that has $100 plus million in revenue to owner-led but IT department that makes all the decisions to sort of very, very small where owner makes all the decisions, right? Where it's a small setup. So there are different ways to sort of slice and dice this whole space. And what we see is some very, very strong assumptions made by startups when they get into the space. They think that it's one vertical and that they'll be able to solve the problem if they look at it from a size perspective and it really doesn't work that way. So what we've come to the conclusion on, we are now looking at IoT startups and saying, are they manufacturing automation startups that are using sensors? So we're kind of widening the problem and saying manufacturing automation. And we are also looking at more specific problems. So what we like to look at is, for example, a recent company that I looked at was trying to solve the problem of their production output and how do they sort of optimize the various constraints that they have around discrete machines and do a, you know, in a environment that's got a very low volume but extremely high mix of SKUs. So they make 14,000 different types of SKUs, but each is very low volume. And how do you optimize for the right outcome? And that problem is seen by a lot of manufacturing companies. So you're almost saying it has nothing to do with vertical. It has nothing to do with size. It has got to do with a specific production problem that exists in the production environment. And we find that to be quite interesting and exciting lens to put on, which is look at the workflow, look at the kind of problems they're trying to solve, and find enough customers that are trying to solve that exact problem. That's one lens of it. The other lens is obviously some verticals or some types of manufacturing face the same kind of issues. If you look at continuous manufacturing, very different kind of problems, and you probably want to do very, very different kind of solutions versus discrete. And we would love to sort of look at companies that are solving those specific problems. We've seen the challenge that you see with IoT companies trying to get into the manufacturing space has been around trying to be, you know, they have to customize their solution. And therefore, you're not sure whether this is a product company or a consulting company. And for us, since we are technology venture capitalists, it's very important we invest our time and money behind companies that are truly changing the game by having a consistent proposition in the market versus trying to sell consulting services where the solution is customized 100 times if it's 100 different customers. So that problem exists in manufacturing. And we've tried to tackle that by saying, tell me exactly the problem you're trying to solve and tell me exactly the set of customers you think are going to use this. And that kind of filters a lot of the startups that have not operated in the manufacturing space and believe they can just come in with some smart ideas and disrupt the space. Because I think that's being very disrespectful to the manufacturing space that relies on high reliability. And just going in there and trying to launch some solutions doesn't really work.
Yeah, I think that's really insightful that you're looking for a particular process that has a problem or an opportunity that is common across a certain group of companies. There's a company called Werma, which is a German mid-sized, I'd say they're not a startup, they've been around for a while, but kind of a mid-sized company in the manufacturing space. And they sell solutions that, you know, provide for manual lines, kind of visibility into bottlenecks and what's happening on the line. But then they also sell a very similar solution into Amazon warehouses. So Amazon, even though they have very sophisticated supply chain, they also have a lot of manual action, and they're now using this. And now we were brainstorming about using potentially a very similar the technology with some minor modifications in an office environment, right? Because you have another environment where you have a lot of manual, you know, access. You need to flag people. You need to basically indicate across, you know, across a team. If you got 100 people or a few hundred people in an office, you also have a similar kind of process challenge with communicating across across this space. So I think you're absolutely right that the technology needs to focus on a problem set and then see which companies, you know, whether they're in the same vertical or different kind of traditional verticals, but which companies have this problem. Last point to discuss, ecosystem. So Asia, I mean, Southeast Asia in particular, I know you guys do have a wider lens, but I think Southeast Asia from an ecosystem perspective, very fragmented, right? It's all, you know, you have a lot of countries that are quite unique kind of in this area, as opposed to China as an example, or the US where you have kind of one country that's a market unto itself, common language, common regulatory, you know, framework. You have a common set of large multinationals that, you know, for example, play a particular role that you can engage with for particular reasons. So how do you as kind of an operational focused VC, how do you cultivate an ecosystem? And what's your view of in Southeast Asia, the important factors and how this impacts startups' growth?
So, you know, I had the opportunity to actually look at some of this stuff when I was working at Google. And I think one of the things, and now at Jungle with a lot of, and C++, where we've seen a lot of data. And one of the things that we've observed is, while it might be fragmented, one of the common themes here is the cities. If you look at the top 10 or 11 cities, you can literally say that a lot of the consumption patterns across these top 10 cities in Southeast Asia look very similar. If you look at social media, if you look at commerce, e-commerce, you look at mobile devices, the way they are used, even in the enterprise environment, very common themes emerge in terms of how to look at some of these cities. So I would say that while that fragmentation is true, and while some of the regulatory requirements may be true, across a certain segment of the population that's meaningful from an income standpoint and decision-making standpoint, you're seeing a lot of homogeneity and very similar kind of patterns emerging, specifically in the city. And if I were to put my thinking hat on, right, and say what percentage is Jakarta of the economy of Indonesia, or what percentage of economy is Ho Chi Minh City of Vietnam, you'll be surprised that a lot of the Southeast Asian countries are actually, a lot of the countries are very concentrated in terms of economy. This is very different, for example, from China, that's kind of spread out across four or five cities. Very different from the United States, that's probably spread out across a few states, and very different from definitely from India, that's again got five or six cities that share the economy a little more equally. It's fascinating that while you bring that up, the answer to that question is, if you do things right, you can actually take some of these propositions across these cities and be successful. So you're seeing the likes of Grab and on the consumer side, or even some of the e-commerce companies do it. On the industrial side, I would argue some of the enterprises that exist in one market do find themselves in other markets as well. And it's not that hard. If you stay focused on a use case that resonates, it's likely to sort of resonate in all the cities because they think very similarly. They have similar economic concentration as far as, you know, decision making goes. For example, if you take an example of Malaysia, if you cover KL, the likelihood that you'll need to actually go to another city is very low. Similar to Philippines, if you do Manila, you're probably done. So, you know, the way we kind of tackle fragmentation is say that that's take a city approach. The other thing I would say is that it is actually an opportunity in some sense because it's harder to build a business. But if you build a business, you're more likely to get acquired. As a venture capital fund that helps its company scale, grow, and get acquired, I think that's not a bad place to be. When an external entity comes in and says, what does it take for me to build a company here? And they see that a company has taken its time, worked hard to actually build out, get over the fragmentation problems or perceived fragmentation problems, the likelihood that they're likely to buy the company are much higher than going after a market where they know that, you know, they can actually achieve the same outcomes by hiring a bunch of smart people and get to the same spot within half the time, right? You see some of those dynamics playing out in India where some of the local players have been threatened by US Silicon Valley companies who've hired really well and, you know, are able to achieve similar outcomes in very little time. Whereas in Southeast Asia, not so much. It's been a harder exercise for a lot of those companies.
Interesting perspective. Thanks so much for taking the time to sit down with us and walk through kind of your company, your investment focus, but also the market more generally.
No worries. I think great questions, and I really appreciate you sort of probing some of those areas because it helps me clarify some of my assumptions.
So let me ask a final question. How do companies reach out to you? And what information, if a company wants to reach out to you, what information do you prefer them to provide you with?
So we've got an email address. So I've got, you know, it's up on my LinkedIn, but we've got hello@seedplus.com, or you can reach out to me at chirayu@seedplus.com. And the information ideally we would like to get is, we would like some material on the company. It can be a deck, it can be an email, a longish email with, or it could be just a document. We are agnostic to the medium that you would like to use. But what we would like is at least a brief about the kind of money you want to raise, the team, and what you're building as a product and what's been sort of the response in the market. That helps us sort of gauge what it will take to sort of build product market fit, you know, just helps us understand whether this is a theme that we want to back and hopefully, you know, have a first meeting with the company.
We'll put all that in the show notes. And again, thanks for taking the time. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to another edition of the Industrial IoT Spotlight. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at IoT1HQ and to check out our database of case studies on IoT1.com. If you have unique insight or a project deployment story to share, we'd love to feature you on a future edition. Write us at eric.walenza@iot1.com.